Welcome to Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me on this rainy Wednesday evening, Elric Kane, how you doing?
I survived the rain, a long drive in the rain. It's always
I had
white
a
knuckle
long ass
stuff.
drive too. Oh my God.
And I
I hate
survived.
driving
I've
in the
joined you in the ranks of people who can die from food allergies this weekend. I was in the emergency because I ate food that obviously had some sort of shellfish, but you couldn't tell it did. And suddenly
I
I
like
had
to
marks
think
all over me.
that
It's crazy.
I'm communicable.
Yeah, maybe it was
So,
you. Maybe just being podcasting with you, this eventually you just become allergic to stuff if you're around like that.
11 years of hanging out with me, sitting next to me in movie theaters, traveling with me, being on planes for long stretches, it's catching. And
Well,
so, welcome to your food allergy.
as soon as I got home from the emergency room, I went straight to peanut butter and I had a spoonful and I was like, "Thank God, I can still do this. My glory, my happy place is your sad place." But obviously, I
Yeah,
can't
I
do that with
can eat an
lobster.
entire
You
lobster.
can't.
So,
Which,
I'm just going to rub that in. I literally had shrimp for lunch
well, I
today.
see. I've
So,
never
yeah.
had a problem. Anytime I've had shrimp, no effect. Anytime I've had even crab, weirdly enough. And so here, what lobster I've had it and mussels, but this was like people are guessing it might have been
So wait,
saying in a sauce.
you've had this reaction
I've had
twice now, and
maybe
you chose not to act on it until you were
it was
like on
so
the
minor.
floor
No,
covered in
these were
hives.
like you have a couple red marks on your arm, so you're like, oh, big deal. That was, and I haven't had it something like that in a few years. So this was like this. I didn't even see anything. It was just something in a sauce. I have to assume maybe oyster sauce or something. And I had red marks all over my. It was intense. It didn't start messing with my throat or anything, but it was
It
definitely
will.
weird. Yeah.
I'm sure that the doctor explained this, that each reaction will get slightly worse because your body will get more hypersensitive to it until you're in full anaphylaxis. So I get to carry your EpiPen
Yeah.
next time we're
I
on
don't
the
know how to get one
plane.
yet. I asked the doctor and they seemed kind of like shrugged their shoulders. I don't even know if they're a real doctor. They weren't dressed like other doctors. He looked like some
Did you
dude
go
who
to an
just,
urgent
yeah.
care? I love urgent
He looked
cares.
like
Those are
some
where I
dude.
walk in and I'm like, I have bronchitis. I need prednisone and an antibiotic. And it's like, thank you. And that's
Other
it.
reasons I'm not that keen on urgent care. Tiny room. It's a Sunday. You go in there with a problem like I have hives on my body, and there's 20 people in there, all with COVID, all coughing, and you're sitting with them, and you're like, oh, now I'm gonna get freaking COVID because I'm sitting around all
So.
these people.
Do you remember like 6 months ago when I had stitches all the way down my eyebrow? I have a bitchin'
Yeah,
scar
you're
from it
usually the
right
one
now
going
that's
to
dying.
urgent care, not me. What's happening?
So that was my wildest adventure because that was a Sunday morning and I tripped and hit my head on a brick flower planter off
That's
my
right.
back porch. I fell down the stairs and hit my head on a brick flower planter and I tore my whole fucking left eyebrow open. I ended up having to get like 10 stitches going
And you
across
bleed a
it.
lot from that
It was
part. I've cut that open
Bleeding
before. Yeah,
like
it's crazy.
crazy.
Yeah.
So I was driven to the urgent care right up the street from me with a dish towel pressed to my forehead. And by the time I got there, the dish towel was just soaked. I walked in and I probably sat in that waiting room for 30 minutes before anybody even said hi to me. Like they asked me for my insurance card the moment I walked in the door and they took that copay, but then I sat down and dripped blood into my
Yeah.
little dish towel for a solid half an hour. And then that was it. And then they called my name and I was like, I don't think I can stand. Like I was so woozy from it. And it was just like, are they just gonna let me bleed out from my head wound in the middle of the waiting room? They did not. I lived, but
I must say I found it because I don't go to places like this very often. I found it very stressful watching. I watched an older guy walks in, goes to the counter, and he says, "I can't breathe. My oxygen machine at home that I use, I dropped it and it broke, and I can't breathe." And they took so long. Like I'm just watching this guy saying things like, "No, I can't actually breathe," and they're like, "Okay, well, just put in your information." And I'm just watching it as a person on the sideline, feeling
Oh
so
my God.
stressed watching people go through
Oh my
protocol
God.
when somebody is literally saying, and I'm just imagining like how I would feel if I actually couldn't breathe. Anyway, medical horror
Oh.
stories aside,
Medical heart. Well, I'm glad that you now know that you're really allergic to shellfish. You're not going to do that again. And welcome to the exciting world of reading everything that you eat. You will read every ingredient, everything. So,
Yeah, I can give up. I'll give up the lobster, but I'm a little. The worrying part was for sure not seeing the thing, and therefore it
you will
being in some
never
other
see the
food.
thing.
But
Okay, so I hope some of our listeners, well, I don't hope you have food allergies, but if you do, I'm sure that you will understand this. You will never know what you're reacting to. 99% of the allergic reactions I've had, I've been in the middle of a bagel a plain bagel with nothing in it, and I will start reacting, going, "What the fuck happened to my bagel?" And it could be anything, as the person who worked at the bagel shop had a walnut bagel before mine and used the same knife to slice it. And that'll do it. That's enough to kick it off. So you will never, 90% of the time, I never know what I'm reacting
Crazy.
to. You just have to assume it's a trace amount of something. But I'm on a fancy new drug for that. So it's been working so far. Knock on my not probably wood IKEA desk. Yeah. So that nothing to do with horror movies. I hope you all enjoyed Food Allergies by Elric and
But I do
Becca.
like that. I do like that. Like good writing, it's good irony that the best meal of my life, of my whole life, was eating an open-faced lobster at the Chelsea Hotel that my uncle took me to.
They don't serve food at the
No,
Chelsea
it's
Hotel.
the Don Quixote, El Quixote,
Don Quixote,
that's
El
been there like a
Quixote is
hundred years.
no, John,
It's El
it's
Quixote, is
gone
it?
now,
Yeah,
but yes.
I got to go there twice with him. Best meal of my life, and it's so cool to think that if I ate that meal right now, I would die. So it's cool that the best meal of my life would also be the last meal of my life. So there's some beautiful irony in there. Perfect for
You
writing.
don't want to go down with an allergic reaction. It'd be
Oh, I
like the
don't
absolute
know.
worst way to go.
But
So,
if I had the
but
choice.
let's, but you could always come back and bang
With a
somebody in the
lobster?
1980s. I don't know. I'm trying to
Oh,
segue
you're
here.
going to
I'm
that
trying to get
movie.
us back
Okay. That
on
wasn't where I
track.
was headed. That we can go to that one first. Well, we had a story around the other one though. Like
Oh, yeah, that's
I
true.
we
So we'll kick off with our story.
Yeah.
So, Elric and I, last, gosh, what was it? Saturday night? We are
No, it's a
Sunday,
Monday or
Monday,
Tuesday or something, yeah.
Monday. Yeah, we were supposed to go see the imaginary press screening, and we show up at the theater to see the imaginary press screening. And there's a press line. These happen all over LA. There's press screenings all over LA, most weeks. Anytime something's opening, they'll do these press screenings. And so we get to the theater and we join a press line. And then we're like, is this the one for Imaginary? And she's like, no, this is the press line for Dune. And we were tempted to stay in it, but it was like 4 hours long and
Yeah.
it was starting at 9 o'clock. And then we realized that we were at the wrong theater
Wrong
that
city.
threw
Wrong
a
city. Multiple.
Monk
Yeah, quite
City.
far
Yeah, like
away.
we were supposed to be in Culver City and there was no way we were going to make it down there. And so we were kind of like, well, fuck, we're at the theater. We plan to come see a movie tonight. What can we see? And quick look on our phone, we realized that stop motion was actually starting there in like 30
Or down
minutes.
the
So
street.
we
Yeah.
down the street.
Which
So
is one I'd
Burbank
wanted to
has,
see more than any
yeah.
movie, new movie. I thought we weren't going to make it to that one because I think it's only out for a week or two,
A
and
week,
then
yeah.
and so we so we, in a sense, we got lucky. I mean, I wish we could have seen Imaginary as well, but we're going to have to we get to talk to the director later in the episode, and we'll have to watch the movie very soon. But
So yeah, we can tantalize the
yes.
movie like yeah. And then when we go see it this weekend, we'll be like all prepped for it. Because we have Jeff Wadlow coming on later. But we got to see stop motion, which I gotta say, when we saw it, I walked away and went, yeah, that was pretty cool. And since then, I have not stopped thinking about it and analyzing it in my head and thinking about particular shots and things that they did. This one has stuck like meat on my bones this entire
It's
week.
a
I love
very,
this.
very well-made movie, and it's really dark. It has a gore, like a body horror gore moment of like kind of self-mutilation type scene that usually it's been many years since I've had to look away from a scene, but not since probably In My Skin, to be honest, when I first saw that. It's similar to that this moment. The whole movie isn't like that,
I
but
literally
it's a
turned
lot.
towards you
Yeah.
in a wince, and you had already turned towards me in a wince. And I just remember looking at you and being like,
No,
"What
it
are you doing?"
was
And you were
actually,
already
yeah.
like winced into a corner.
It's
And yeah.
a sign they're building the gag so well. But the movie, that's just one element of the movie where it's going. But it's just a really clever, interesting, like it's a movie I'd heard very little about. I'd heard it was good. It's a stop motion. There's a woman who is a stop motion animator who has obviously been a legend in her field, but she's getting older. She might have had a stroke at some point, so she can't manipulate the figures like she used
She has
to.
arthritis. Her
Okay.
hands are locked up from
Yeah, and
arthritis.
so she, instead she has her daughter who is also wants to be an animator and has obviously grown up in the shadow under her mother, and she's very controlling of her daughter, and it's quite a mommy dearest kind of relationship, it seems. And you know, all her friends and she's still hip and young and hangs out with her friends who are also animators doing things for cool companies, but when she comes home she has to just like move things by an inch for her mother under her rule and is too scared to kind of speak out against her. That's how we meet the character.
And then her, once she kind of strikes out on her own, her mother has an accident fairly quickly, and she is kind of left finally to make her own animations. She sinks into them in such a psychological, both kind of physical, like working herself constantly to make something, but really becomes so psychologically invested in it that she begins to go insane. I can best sum it up as Brothers Quay do Barbarian Sound
Or
Studio.
Repulsion. I feel like the Repulsion, the
Repulsion, yeah.
descent in Repulsion is very similar, but you're right with the Quays, right? Like it's somebody do, and so it has this very beautiful stop motion animation throughout the film, by the person who did work on Infinity Pool, Wounded Fawn, a lot of films that use that kind of have had elements, but it's a big part of this storyline, and it's
Yeah, it's
beautifully
huge.
made. And the horrors
And
in her
this.
story start to enter her real life, or it's just a psychosis that she's externalizing, and we don't know. It dances the line nicely between the
Yeah,
two.
this gets so graphic, so cringy. A lot of times, much like a Barbarian Sound Studio, you won't necessarily know what's real and what's not. They just become so kind of invested in the work that it all begins to merge. Don't go into this expecting a perfectly linear plot. It didn't have, like, that's literally as Elric and I were walking back to the car afterwards. I remember we had, like,
It's
it
more the
does
pacing,
not,
right? It's less the
it's
linear.
not plot, it's pacing.
It's not paced in a way that you're going to feel it like moving and tearing because there isn't much story, but it's the way it's being delivered that keeps you on the hook. And she's really good. Aisling Franciosi, I had to look, I realized she's the actress from The
Last
Nightingale.
Voyage of the Demeter. Yeah,
Oh,
and The
the Demeter. Okay,
Nightingale.
yeah.
Yeah. So,
She's
but
good.
this movie is amazing. You should definitely go see it. But Elric, we are missing the biggest part of our adventure going to see this movie, which is the people who sat next to
Well, it
us.
started here. People will understand this. We went to th it said there was only two seats at the very front, and so you bought the seats. And then we entered the theater, and there's no one in this theater. Like 10 minutes before, it's completely empty, and we're like, "Oh, we
And we're
didn't go
like,
anywhere."
why are we sitting? Literally, this is in a very small theater. We're like maybe 2 feet from the screen, staring straight up, like craning our necks. And we're like, let's just scoot back. Nobody's
And
here.
like a good horror movie, every 2 minutes, more people enter, and suddenly our seat's gonna get. Yes, of course, we're in someone's seats. We move one time and we land in the perfect seats. And then we turn around and the place is completely
It's
full on
packed.
a Tuesday night for a movie called Stop Motion that I've heard zero press about. Very impressive to be whoever's running that, running the ads on this one or getting butts in the seat. And there was two seats next to us, and you went out to get popcorn, I think, at the very start. There were about 10
I
minutes into the
did.
movie. A girl and a guy come in for these seats, and the girl, I've never had somebody do this to me. They lean over and she like grabs my arm and leans in close and says, "Oh, so how much have I missed and what's happening?" And I just looked at her like,
Like she's
"What?"
expecting you to give her a plot
In the middle of
summary.
the movie. And I'm like, "You already had 30 minutes of trailers, you miss lady." Like it was very odd. So I should have known then that we're in for trouble, but it wasn't until you got there that the real trouble began.
So then I get back with my popcorn and I sit down and she's talking constantly. Like, and it's just stupid stuff. Like, she's literally narrating what's happening on screen. Oh, look, she's running. Why doesn't she have shoes on? Oh, she's wearing a white dress now. Oh, is it she's going to bed? I bet she's going to wake up. Do you think she's still going to be working on the film? Like, she's literally narrating the movie. But every couple of minutes, she will come up with a question about what's happening on screen and she'll pull out her phone and fucking Google that shit. So it will be like, oh, look, she has an accent. Is this Australian? It's not. But then she'll pull out her phone and sit there and Google it for a while. And this just keeps going and going and going. Until it reaches a point where she's not even interested in the movie anymore. This girl has like completely lost contact with the film. She could give a fuck what's happening on screen. Literally, at one point, and I laughed out loud at this point, to the point that Elric became very aware of what was happening. She just looks at her guy that she's with and she goes, "We should visit Italy sometime." And she says this full volume. Phone comes out. She's Googling Italy, zooming in on Manaus, looking at landmarks. And then there was this other time, and she knows I'm pissed. Like, she is feeling that I'm getting pissed off at her. And she keeps looking over at me and glaring, and there's no other seats in the theater or else we would have moved. But then there was another time, I'm sitting there eating my popcorn, and all of a sudden I see this like spritz come out from her. Like she's been digging through her purse, and then all of a sudden, this spritz comes out, and suddenly I smell cotton candy. And I'm like, did bitch just spray body spray in the middle of the theater? And I look over, it's not body spray. She's fucking vaping in the middle of the theater.
Yeah, while looking up
And oh my
Italy.
God, while looking out, Googling Italy, it was just
I
the
hope she made it.
wildest.
Hope she made it.
And it reached a point where it was no longer like giving her dirty looks or shushing her, or she knew I was pissed about the vaping thing too, because she put that away real quickly. But it became kind of a let's see where this goes. Like, is she drunk? We don't even figure it out. It was just
It
the
was also a weird
wildest.
movie to go. Like, I was like, why are they here on a Tuesday if they don't even like, like.
Neither of them knew anything about it either. I can only assume that, much like me, they have an AMC pass. So sometimes they
Yeah.
just go into movies like I do. Like, I had no interest in seeing Argylle, but I had a spare Monday night and I went, and it wasn't great. But yeah, like, I will sometimes just go to movies because I do have that free thing. So that's my only guess, because these people kept talking the whole time about how gross the movie was, about how stupid it was, about how, that it wasn't, there was no monsters in it. I was like, shut up, for the love of bejesus, shut up. So yeah, it was, that was by far one of the wildest
That
viewing
was the worst,
experiences
like, yeah,
I've had.
seat people I've had in many years. I know a lot of people complain about. I actually have pretty good luck for the most part when I'm in theaters. I obviously, if you go to places like NewBev, everyone has to behave, but
Oh yeah.
this was definitely the craziest, and there's no one to
Oh,
tell them otherwise, you know?
no one,
Yeah.
no one. It was wild. But that said, the movie was awesome, so much so that I will completely forget about her and wish her well on her trip to Italy. So that, we got to enjoy stop
And she
motion, which
doesn't, I
was,
don't think she comes with Shutter subscriptions, so that's good.
I don't think
So if
so.
I believe this will
She
be a Shutter release, so people can watch it without
did
her.
not seem like a Shutter
No, I don't think so.
subscriber. Where was this movie? Oh, wait, we looked this up. This was UK.
It's definitely, yeah, it was definitely European. I know she, like, it seemed
Is she Australian?
she's not, weirdly enough, even though she's a Nightingale,
Okay.
she's Italian.
Okay,
You
because
know.
that was the question, was, is this in Australia? And then they're like Googling
They probably looked up
Australian
the
things.
actress and then
Wow.
saw she was Italian. And then she's like, "We should go to Italy." That's probably how this happened.
Probably
Probably
it.
the
Oh my
dart.
God.
But anyway, this has got a
Oh.
great, great delusion, downfall, body horror, has a lot of different elements, and it's just a really cool, definitely one of the better horror films of the year so far. Which we should follow it up with another really good horror film of the year, one that I saw and then I recommend you, and then you start straight away. Because I
Yep.
knew you would like it because it's so much, the setup especially is so much like a lot of things you've talked about lately, whether they're true crime stories or so. I'll let you set up a monologue.
Okay. So honestly, this is, if I was to make a list right now, this is probably in my top five of the year so
Yeah.
far. We'll see how it fares.
Yeah.
We're only in March, early March, so we'll see how it fares as the year goes on. But I really, really liked this. This is Monolith. Played festivals in 2022, 2023. I know it
It's
went to
brand new now,
Overload.
yeah, in terms of being released out.
And it's just now going to VOD. Like, it did a festival run like a year ago, and it's just now going to VOD. This is an Australian film. So yeah, she was right on that one. This one is an Australian film. This one is a one-hander, meaning that there is basically only one actress the entire time. We hear other people's voices, but for the most part, it is just one actress by herself in a house. And I am always so impressed with these and how they are done. The whole setup of this is, she is a true crime podcaster, and she has this really popular true crime show. But she has, for lack of a kind of a better way of putting it, she's been kind of canceled, or more of like her credibility has been dinged, because she had been adamantly saying that this one guy was a criminal, that he did the crime, and he was later in a court of law proven not guilty. And so she had been like rallying against this one person, saying he's the killer, he did it. And then once he was proven innocent, her credibility gets really dinged. So she was dropped by her network. She lost a lot of her fan base. A lot of people were calling her a liar. They were saying that she's just an instigator, that she's a hack. And then she gets picked up by this other network, and she is now supposed to deliver her first show for this new network. And she's basically having podcaster's block, if that's a thing. Like, she doesn't know what to do. She is so kind of got PTSD and trauma from everything that has gone down. on that last show that she doesn't really know what to do. So she's, because she got doxxed as part of that, she's now she's had to leave her apartment and she is staying by herself in her parents' old vacation home, which was like their childhood home. So she is by herself in her parents' old her childhood home trying to craft out some type of podcast. And in all of the emails about what a horrible person she is, you know, you should die, bitch. She gets one email that just says, you should call this person, Flora May, and ask about the brick. And she's like, well, what the hell? So she calls the number, and Flora May, who she doesn't know, gets on the phone and says, hi, I'm a podcaster. I focus on true crime and weird mysteries. I'm supposed to ask you about the brick. And Flora May doesn't really know what she's talking about. But after a while, she kind of realizes what she is talking about is that this woman on the phone says that at some point in her life, this black brick was given to her. And she doesn't really, she there's a story of how she got it, but it was given to her and she found it. And she said that it basically understood her and that there was something to it, that it was like the brick was part of her being. And it wasn't even like a brick, it was just brick shaped. It was like a black rock thing that understood her being and, you know, had these mystical powers. And when she looked at it, she understood truths about the universe, but it also made it feel like something bigger was coming, like something bad was going to happen. And so the podcaster is kind of like, yeah, whatever, this sounds like a weird story. But once she runs it on air, other people start coming forward saying that they too have received these black bricks. And some of them have these crazy stories about how they got it. Sometimes they're having visions with it, like they're seeing other versions of themselves, other versions of the world. Sometimes they're seeing more kind of otherworldly stuff. And it's becoming, she's realizing that it's like a phenomenon. And she's tracking like 20 different people who claim to have received these bricks. That's as far as I'll take it because I don't want to go past that because it gets
Yeah, and
weird.
then because it hasn't got all that much to, you know, because it's a single location, it does circle back to the, and this I don't think is a spoiler, but it's why the movie's so good. It circles back to being also about her, and she becomes implicated as one of these stories that she is certainly not expecting when she starts chasing it down. So we won't say more than that, but
Yeah.
the performance is also really good. It's Lily Sullivan, who is the star of the Evil Dead Rise
Evil
movie,
Dead
and
Arise.
she's really good. She's just really a really captivating performance, very simple. And it does go somewhere. It's like pretty cool. I definitely, while I watched the first 30 minutes, which I really like the setup of this even more, I was like thinking of you that first 30 minutes because it just seems like the kind of things you like where there's almost a game to it of, you know, this leads to this down the rabbit hole, conspiracy to conspiracy.
Mysteries. I love mysteries in any capacity. So yeah, this kind of conspiracy theory rabbit hole type. I love these movies. Anytime it does this. And I mean, I feel like this is my same love of like Curse of Oak Island, which there's a new episode tonight I'm dying to watch, or like National Treasure. Like my love of those movies, it's the same kind of like this leads to this rabbit hole. But yeah, this, it was so tight, it was so small. And the third act gets really fucking weird and experimental. Like it gets unusually weird, but really cool with what it does with it. So I dug this one so
Yeah,
much.
I agree. I think this is definitely one of the better ones I've seen so far this year too. Oh, and as was Stop Motion. But this is just very unique in its simplicity. So that's Monolith. I think I saw that on Amazon Prime rented.
Yeah, it was a $6.99 rental for me. Yeah, really tight movie. Okay, I just realized we watched all the same stuff this week, except for I have one variant and some books. So let's take it to the next one that we watched together, Lisa Frankenstein.
Yeah, interesting. So this was Zelda Williams, not the Zelda Adams, as I thought last time. Zelda Williams, who's Robin Williams' daughter, first feature. Diablo Cody's voice is obviously comes through very strongly in this. I had no expectations for this. I know it didn't necessarily light the world on fire, and I saw mixed reactions. Obviously, some people really don't like it. Some people thought it was really fun and loved it. And so I kind of just sat there. It was like the end of a night, going, "Am I gonna want to watch this? I'll watch 5 minutes of it." And then I just kind of found it charming and kind of enjoyed myself, and I thought what Catherine Newton was doing in it was so weird and funny as a performance, because from frame one she's weird in this movie. It's like a, you know, she loses her mother to some tragedy in the past that's never really explained, and she now lives with a stepsister who literally steals the movie. The stepsister is one of those performances playing a role that's I feel like if you watched every 80s movie in the history of 80s movie, no one has ever created this character, which is
No,
the
because
kind mean girl.
she is the kind
It's
mean girl. She
amazing.
is popular.
I
She
loved it.
is a cheerleader. She is like president of everything. Everybody at the school loves her. She's
And a
pretty, and
stepsister
she
too.
is so nice that that she just can't get over it. Like, her stepsister just wants to hate her and everything that
She's
she's doing, but she is going out of her way to invite her to parties and try to get her into clubs. And so, yeah, she is the nice mean girl.
so it's it was just so refreshing because you just get so used to old tropes that when suddenly you have a stepsister who's also one of the popular girls, she's always out looking out for her stepsister and she's trying to create a family. Her name's Liz Saberano. I had to write it down because afterwards I was like, that is to me the kind of performance that somebody like, it's just the supporting role where I would now want to see that person in a lot more movies.
Playing stepsister Taffy was
And her
great.
mom, who's really bitchy, played by Claudia Gugino, who we all love from the Mike Flanagan universe of late. And I always love her. And she's getting to play, a very uptight, really cruel mom character, which is what you would expect the sister to be, but she's not. But yeah, well, what is the hook? It's interesting how they bring the dead thing back in a way.
So yes, Lisa is her mom is dead, and she has now gotten a new stepsister and stepmom. Her dad is remarried, and she has just kind of moved to this town. It's her senior year of high school, and she didn't want to just move to this town, but she has. And she is very weird. She's got a gothic edge to her. And so she doesn't really want to be a cheerleader or join any of these clubs that her sister, stepsister Taffy, is trying to encourage her to. So she spends most of her time sitting in a nearby graveyard, talking to this kind of obelisk statue of this handsome young man who died in the 1800s. And she talks to him. And one day she brings him a little gift. She keeps his grave tended, and she tells him stories that are going on in her life. And one night there is this massive storm, and the grave gets struck by lightning, and he comes back, but he doesn't know what else to do. So he goes to her and lives in her closet.
And he's a full zombie when he first comes back. He just looks scary. So she's obviously scared. And as she starts to kind of dress him up, and he's eventually wearing a violent femme shirt, she realizes the tanning bed can give him electric shocks that will, make him just slightly more human and slightly more lifelike. And it's just a very cute, like, don't go on for the horror. The horror, it's got horror elements and looks. But no, this is a movie that's very much like an 80s teen comedy with a strong Diablo Cody voice, and some people that's a negative, but I just there's something about it that I found quite refreshing. I didn't know if the ending kind of maybe in the last few
Ending
minutes
did
it fell
not
apart.
work.
Yeah,
I was kind of like, it's got a weird denouement at the
yeah,
end that feels almost tacked
yes,
on and kind of cheapens the rest of the movie for
yeah,
me. So, but it's the last 30 seconds, and I didn't understand it. Like, there were certain things that it did where I was like, I don't get this.
Yeah, no, it
But
definitely didn't
that.
deliver at the very end, but it was a lot of fun getting there, and the performances are strange, and some of the teen dynamics are fun, and the color and design, it's like, again, it's very poppy. It's definitely meant for a younger audience, but like honestly, I did not expect to enjoy it, and I was having fun watching it, and I wasn't taking it all too seriously. Maybe it strays a little too into the Tim Burton lane. It would be better not going there at times and just staying in the 80s, but
Yeah, it does definitely, especially at the end, it gets kind of Tim Burton-y. But that said, up to that point, I was really into this, had a great time with it. Very 1980s referential as well. It was kind of like, they're referencing jellies and diet chocolate soda, which I completely forgot was a thing. But it was totally a thing. And so yeah, kind of even just the trip back and how they were referencing, like, what it was to be a kid in the 80s was really fun.
Yeah, and again, Catherine Newton is doing really good work in the last few, from Freaky and onwards. She's super interesting. So she's re definitely reminding me of Catherine Isabel from Ginger Snaps in this one, which I thought was cool. But yeah, no, again, so it's a soft recommendation. I do think for some people they're gonna love it because of just the kind of style and color. It's the movie you're hoping would come out this year, and other people, it was a big release, right? So
It was. I
impressed.
mean, it did a wide. So, which horror comedies are
It's
always
tough.
kind of hit or miss on those wides. I mean, I felt the same way about Renfield, where I walked away saying, "Oh my God, I loved this so much," and then, watched other people tear it apart online. So, horror comedies are just a hard sell right now across the board. But God, I want more of
And I will
them.
say, like, if I had seen that in the teaser kind of promos, I would have thought this was made for teen or younger girls. And then you watch the movie, and so much of the movie's about sex. So I was
It most
like,
of it, because that's her goal, is to lose her virginity. That is her goal throughout like her senior year of high school, and there's like references to masturbation
Yeah,
and
no,
stuff.
quite a lot. It wouldn't be that appropriate for somebody under like, 15 or 14. So watching it, I was like, oh yeah, maybe it hits a weird
I don't
wave.
know. I feel like some of that would have gone over. Like, I debated letting my Marnie see it because I feel like some of it would have gone over her head. Like, I
There's a
think, like,
contraption that you wouldn't understand in that context. No, yeah.
There was certain, I mean, like, I watched movies like that when I
Yeah,
was
we
a
all do.
kid
Yeah,
and
yeah.
didn't really pick up on it until much, much later. And then I was like, oh, that's what they're talking about. Like, I feel like there's moments that, just would have gone over.
Yeah,
So
it's
I may
fine.
still let Marnie watch
Yeah.
it just because it does feel like it's for that preteen
I
audience
say
to a degree.
test it on her and then report back to us if it worked.
I will let you
Then we'll
know.
know.
If she asks, honestly, she's been watching Hazbin Hotel, which if you have not seen, it's a musical horror animated show on Amazon. Fucking amazing. She's been watching that and it's far more adult than anything that she's going to see on here. You know what? I'll do a bigger
Okay.
report on Hazbin Hotel next week. It's great. And it's definitely got a lot of hard notes to it. So
The only one I watched that you didn't, but you watched that last show, and I think I liked it less, was Here for Blood. You told me you didn't think it was going to be
I
my
told you, I was like,
bag.
it's not gonna be your bag, dude. Don't dive into
I
that
will
one. It's not for
say
you.
it's a weird thing. There are certain movies that filmed now that if this was from the 80s, like if it was actually from the 80s and shot on film and it was the exact same movie, I think I probably would have loved it. And so I didn't hate it. It was just like there's certain things that don't work as well now for me. I will say I think the wrestler guy in it is excellent. Like he
Yes.
was really fun, really well used, and there's some really good gags all the way through. And so I don't want to get too into the weeds. I still kind of had fun, but like kind of dumb fun, and it's silly, and but some people, this is the movie they need, so I understand that. So I'm not going to rob you of that pleasure. But that one's on Screambox.
So I am going to quickly say I watch Suburban Screams. This is
No
the John
Alexa.
Carpenter TV show that went to Peacock. I think it was December of
Yeah.
last year. And I'd had this on my queue for a while and was kind of like, it didn't get very good reviews at all. But I was doing something this weekend and I was like, I can't throw on. It was admittedly, I was painting a camper. And I was like, I don't have enough focus right now to throw on a movie, but this seems kind of like, little anthologies I could totally do right now. So I put this on. I don't know about this one.
Yeah, that's how I
Then
felt
again,
mostly, yeah.
it hasn't gotten good reviews. So the setup is that it is set and designed and formatted like a true crime show. It's supposed to feel like a Forensics Files, a Dateline, another, or the First 48, all three of which I love those shows. And so the setup is that it's going to be people interviewing about the real life thing that happened to them while simultaneously you're watching reenactments of what happened. So this is literally like how Dateline is set up, where you're going to sit down and you're going to see a talking head person talking about how, oh my gosh, I saw this ghost. It scared the shit out of me. Cut to reenactment of them being scared by the ghost. I get the format. It seems like a cool setup to do that same format with real scary stuff. So that's kind of the approach, is it's that same true crime setup, but these are supposed to be real scary, honest to God things that happen in the suburbs, which is why it's called Suburban Scream. And so some of them are supernatural. Some of them are like Ouija boards, we moved into a house and there was a ghost. And then other ones, and this is where it got weird, are just killers. And then it feels almost exploitive because it's handling it like a horror film. But when you step back, you're realizing that these are actual real killers. Like, it doesn't handle it with the kind of sensitivity and somberness that like a Forensics Files or a Dateline does. It's handling it like a really fun horror film. And then, but then these people are cutting away and being like, yeah, that was my mom that was killed. And it felt
Yeah,
weird.
and the
It felt
ghosts, like a
really
young
weird.
girl was drowned and she's the ghost of the person. And it's like kind of fun to watch the recreation, but then when it's the real people, you're like, oh, I don't like the way this feels. I felt I only watched about three of them, I think, but there was one where I was really like, oh, this is a weird line that I haven't quite
It
seen done like
felt
this before, but not in a good
weird.
way.
Yeah, it was an interesting, I'm going to call it an interesting experiment, because on paper, if I had been an exec and you were like, let's cover supernatural stories, but in like that true crime format, I would have been like, holy shit, this sounds amazing. Yes, reenact your bad Ouija board experience for me. But there was just something about the execution, especially when they got into kind of the more serial killer stuff, that felt weird. The reason that I went to this show that I'd had it on my queue for so long is that they cover something that happened in Virginia, really close to my house, the Bunny Man episode, which I think was episode 4 or 5,
I didn't get to that
about,
one.
and so it's this long-running legend in Fairfax, Virginia, which is where I moved right after college, about how supposedly there was this serial killer. There's like a bajillion different origin stories, but the one that is most common is that there was this serial killer who always dressed up like a bunny man, and he hung out in this bridge in Fairfax, and it was called Bunny Man Bridge. And you would still see him like going through the woods, and he was dressed like a bunny and carried an axe, and supposedly he killed all these people. And whether he was an escaped mental patient or he was like a deranged Easter bunny guy who got made fun of because he was like posing with kids at Easter and they ran him out of town and all this stuff, there's all these different theories of how he got there. So it was that episode that made me want to watch. But again, it was going back to like a serial killery vibe. So yeah, but presenting it as a fun horror movie, it was a weird mix. So I don't know how I feel about it yet, because some of the stories were cool, but yeah, it was a weird tone to get through.
At least John Carpenter
But
got
yeah.
to direct from his couch. Have you ever seen how that's apparently how they made it? He didn't even have to leave his couch to direct it, and it was all done on a video, and he was just telling people what to do. I've seen him making, and I was like, well, I guess for John, that's a good way to
Wow.
that's a good gig.
I wanted this to be better than it was, but that said, I'm still happy we're getting something from John Carpenter.
He
Like,
only did one
again,
of the stories.
yeah, the other ones are somebody else. So okay, I've got some books, but do you have anything
No,
else?
that's me.
Okay, I'm gonna rush through some books. I won't rush because some of these I really liked. So this was my week of novellas, and then I've got one novel that I finished. I am gonna start off with Joshua Hull's Mouth. So Joshua Hull, co-writer on my film Glorious, has a novella coming out from Tenebris Press, Mouth, about a guy
I
who
love that
literally
journey from a
finds.
glory hole to a mouth. I am so impressed.
It's Joshua. This is what he does, is he does these really kind of absurdist, funny, yet really dark stories. And this is 100% Joshua Hull, where it is about a guy who one day finds this massive mouth with teeth in the middle of a farm. And he has been hired to kind of start feeding it and take care of mouth. And yeah, and so it's hilariously twisted, so fucked up, but amazing. So yeah, this is pure Joshua Hull. So this is coming out very soon from Tenebris Press.
That's
So
a
the next
novel
one,
or a graphic novel?
novella.
Novella,
So
okay.
this is a novella. So it's such like lame, like, definitions. A novella, I can't even remember what I was told. A novel is over 200. Anything under that is a novella, but that determination is different based on publisher. Some publishers will take a novella and sell it as a novel, and vice versa. And so this is technically a novella, but it's just a damn good read. I read it in 2 days, so we'll say it's short. I love novellas for that reason. It's short and I can get through it, and it's like a quick little burst of fun. So Mouth from Tenebris Press. Also from Tenebris Press, because I picked up a couple of things. This was recommended by Daniel Kraus when he was on our Patreon episode back at Christmas time. And this is One Hand to Hold, One Hand to Carve, about a guy who is on a slab, dead person on a slab, and somebody is in the middle of an autopsy, literally saws the person down the middle. Suddenly, both halves of the corpse burst back to life. They have no memory of their prior life, but they have distinctive personalities now. Like, they have vastly different personalities. This is some super heady, absurdist, surrealist, philosophical shit about human nature and two halves of a whole and different ways to approach things. And it gets all types of fucked up and twisted. I can see why Daniel recommended this to us. You would love
Yeah,
this.
it looks, that
This
sounds really
it's
interesting.
It's such a fascinating, absurdist setup, but it goes so cool places.
And
Yeah. Like,
by speaking of him, cool news I saw on his socials yesterday that his new book that was with George Romero like a second one that no one knew existed that George Romero had written, and he finished is coming out, which I just reading about it sounded really neat and interesting. So always
That's
cool to keep that legacy going.
yay, Daniel Kraus. We're gonna have to bring you back on our
Keep that
Patreon show
talent.
soon because you gave us some deep cuts I had not seen
Yeah, there's
before,
some
and
good ones.
that's an impressive feat. I read 12 Hours, which is the other novella that I read this week, by L. Marie Woods. This one's from Screaming Dog or Raw Dog Screaming Press. And this one is it opens with a cab driver being attacked, and they lay there unconscious for 12 hours, paralyzed, while things are happening around them, and they're trying to piece together what happened, who attacked them, why they're paralyzed, what's going on as they stare up at the ceiling of the cab. So this one, it was real stream of consciousness. This was not a quick read because it was so kind of stream of conscious reading, but it was a really cool kind of setup of how they're approaching what happened, who attacked them, and everything. So I at least wanted to mention that. Not completely horror, but it's got a lot of horror notes to it. Okay, this last one, novel I finished. This one does not come out till March 26th, so it has not hit stands yet. But this is Penguin Random House Monsters We Have Made. And I was telling you about this when we were at the movies a couple nights ago because I was really enjoying it. The setup of this is that it's from a mom's perspective. And when the mom's kid is like maybe 12, 13 years old, I can't even remember the age. Her daughter Faye becomes obsessed with this online kind of story, creepypasta about this otherworldly supernatural being that she's reading stories about online called the Kingsman. And her best friend become so obsessed with the Kingsman that they attack and stab their babysitter, trying to sacrifice her for the Kingsman. So it's very much kind of based off the real life adventure, true crime stuff that happened with Slender Man, where he was this online phenomenon. People became so obsessed and affected by him that eventually two young girls attacked somebody thinking that they were doing it for Slender Man. That's definitely kind of the start of this. But it then fast forwards 14 years. The girl who had done that crime, Faye, you know, she went off to a rehab facility. She did all this psychiatric stuff. She's been in and out of different facilities her entire life. Her mom is now divorced and living by herself. And one day she gets word that her daughter has gone missing. Her daughter, now who is now 23, has a daughter of her own, has gone missing and left her daughter with somebody else, which the mom then gets it. So she, grandma now has her granddaughter, but Faye at age 23 has gone missing. And she gets word that she was reaching out to this professor who has been researching the Kingsman. And the Kingsman has basically come back, and that they have gone off on some type of hunt for the Kingsman to try to prove that it was real. And the Kingsman, it's a really cool story because much like Slender Man, how they did kind of those doctored photos where you would see it pop up and he was in all these different time zones and time periods. And oh, look, here he is in the Victorian times. There's all of these historically documented things about the Kingsman was there in ancient Egypt and he was here again in the 1700s and part of the Civil War. And so there's all of this historical stuff that the Kingsman has been here for a long time. And if you do the Kingsman bidding, in that case, they were trying to sacrifice their babysitter, he will let you into kind of his magical kingdom and give you everything that you wish for in the world, is what they were aiming for. So it's Slender Man if 15 years later, those girls kind of continue their hunt and it comes back. So this was a really cool setup. And I deeply enjoyed where this went. So Monsters We Have Made
Who wrote that?
comes. This is Lindsay Stark.
Okay.
Might be a first-time writer. I'm not familiar with her other stuff. Don't quote me on that one. I'm not too sure. I haven't researched it much yet. But yeah, this was a really cool one coming out in 2 weeks, 2, 3 weeks, March 26th from Penguin Random House.
Yeah, my readings took a turn because I had to go back to work, and suddenly I'm stuck on
That's when I do the most.
yeah, I've been reading this one. I think I'd mentioned it. I'm not gonna. I've been stuck in it for a couple weeks because it doesn't have kind of like stop motion where it doesn't have the story engine, but it's so well written. It's called The Shadow Knows. And so it's not, so this is like not me not recommending it. It's so well written that it's the story behind it that will interest our horror listeners. And the reason I picked it up is because Grady Hendrix posted about it, but I didn't know this, which is that Stanley Kubrick read this book, The Shadow Knows, and he straight away looked up this author, and he called her and said, I need you to co-write a movie with me because I want a woman's perspective, especially on the stuff about divorce. And that movie was The Shining. And I did not know that. So this book is responsible for her joining him to write that adaptation of The
So
Shining.
the author of this book wrote the adaptation of The Shining.
With Kubrick. So they had, and so
Wow.
I never knew this story, and I'm obsessed with that movie. So it's funny that I didn't. So reading this book, and I see it completely. Like, she is such a good writer of the inner working of the mind of a woman who's recently got multiple kids and is recently separated from a partner and was having an affair with someone. And she's it's so truthful. It's insane. It's like the most truthful stream of conscious book I think I've ever read because it's also funny, but I don't know what, like, she basically thinks she's going to be murdered any day. She's like, at some point I'm going to be murdered. I know this is about to happen, but it has so far the story part, I'm about halfway, hasn't really kicked in. So you keep reading. It's more like I read a few pages and it's great. And then I put it down and it's not like the other novels I've been reading where the story is the thing that gets you through. So once I finish this, I'll go back to it and get back in the flow. But I'm really glad I'm reading it because she her voice is, you know, it's really terrific. And it, obviously some of that was like directly put into Shelley Duvall, and some of it's probably what you're seeing behind the wheels of Shelley Duvall's eyes. And some of it's maybe in the way we portray Jack as, you know, a bigger than life character. It's really neat when you when somebody points like Grady or somebody points something like that out to you that you didn't realize. So but yeah, I'm enjoying it as a read too, but I just am stuck. I've been in there for a couple weeks. I was on such a good tear, but I'll get back.
Well, now, and this wouldn't be the one to do it, but this is how I read two books simultaneously, is I will have the one that I am reading, like I lay in bed every night and read until I fall asleep and smack myself in the face with it. And then I will have the one that I'm listening to in the
Right, that makes
car.
sense, yeah.
And because it's two different formats, I can mentally keep them separate. It's like watching two different TV shows at the same time. Like it's easy to do. And so I am going to deeply encourage you, when you get in that car to drive to work tomorrow morning, before you do it, get yourself an Audible book to listen to. Why isn't Audible sponsoring our fucking podcast? We should get on
We
that.
want Goodreads. We'll have to get Goodreads.
Goodreads is great, but yeah, you need to get yourself an audio book
They're
and get
probably not
started.
sponsoring us because I've said I've never listened to one. So they're like, screw
I
that guy.
know. They're like, fuck that guy. That guy doesn't listen.
Unfortunately, if I
Whereas
was to listen to
I.
books, I would not be able to do any more writing because that's of the drive-in is when I talk to my writing partner because he's on a different coast. So it's like, it's one way we can generate a lot of ideas is that,
Oh yeah, I forgot you
yeah.
and Webb do like your writing meetings while you're
Because I've got
driving.
such a long
See,
commute, it might as well, you know?
I would get so frustrated.
Yeah.
Like I can't think analytically or in any type of like legible way while I'm driving. I have to zone out. So listening to like a book really does it for me. Otherwise, I don't handle traffic well. Like I'll have a full anxiety attack if I have to focus on a conversation with somebody and crawl down the five every
No,
day.
I've got
So
like a longer, open drive. But I've always ideas always come best when I'm in motion, like in a train or on a bus or, you know, for whatever reason, I find. Whereas I'm at home, I feel like stagnant or something. But
Mine is always when I'm sitting in cafes,
that's
like,
a good one.
and I usually do that like two times a week where I will leave my house because anytime I'm writing, it's here at my house on my shitty IKEA desk. And it will be functional. But if I leave, like, I really like working at Whole Foods. Like, the restaurant at Whole Foods, like, nobody has any expectations. It's not like Starbucks where somebody's waiting for you to leave so they can snag your table. You don't have to keep going back and buying things. Nobody's paying attention to you at the restaurant at Whole Foods. So I go there and I will sit for hours. And that is where, you know, if I'm looking for idea sparks, I have to like break my pattern to do that. So yeah, that I go up to, the Coral Cafe, which I make you meet me at all the time.
Good cherry
That's kind of
pie.
my
Good pie.
standard. Yeah, the cherry. I always get the biscuits. That's like my standard writing spot. But as of late during the days, I've been doing Whole Foods. So yeah, it's a
Hey, you
weird
always
one.
get tips.
Yeah, it's where you go to write and buy good muffins. So yeah.
And how to look up Italy while in a movie theater watching Powerful.
Yes. Go to Italy. Okay, well, we're not going to go to Italy this week. Instead, we are going to dive into imaginary friends. So stick with us, and we'll be back after the break with director Jeff Wadlow and some of our favorite deep cut toy horror movie picks. Welcome Welcome back, everybody. We are excited for a guest that we have tried to have on for a couple of films now, and we're finally getting to it with his film Imaginary, coming to theaters this weekend. Let me welcome on the show Jeff Wadlow. So good to finally get you on here.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here. I love talking with fellow film nerds. So have a good time.
Well, that definitely sums us up. So yeah, I've been wanting to dive into your entire career, but I know we only have a little bit of time. So I'm going to start with Imaginary and then we're going to work our way back.
That's cool.
So yeah. So I want to know kind of where did the idea of this come out of? Was this a script that was brought to you? And then kind of how did you put your own spin on it? Or is this like an original creation of messed up teddy bear wants to eat your face?
This is an original creation, but not mine. It's an original creation that I collaborated on. I'm a one-third creator, I guess you could say, with Greg Erb and Jason Ormlin, who are good friends of mine. I'd signed a first look deal with Jason Blum at Blumhouse after Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island. He challenged me, as he always does, all my movies with him begin with a challenge. He challenged me on this one to come up with a classic Blumhouse movie. They had gotten really into real
reboots.
World. Yeah. Well, they got into sort of real world, very dark horror movies with the Purge films and Halloween. He just wanted to get back to that fun, supernatural, family moves into a house, bump in the night kind of Blumhouse movie. And I'd always wanted to do an imaginary friend movie to play with subjectivity and kind of tease the audience with what's real and what's not, but ask if the thing that's not real still has real world consequences. It's something similar to what I did in Cry Wolf with Liars, right? And subjectivity. And because I had this first look deal, I was talking to other writers and I'd been friends with Greg Erb for about, 15, 20 years at that point. We started in Hollywood together and lived in the same terrible apartment complex when we were in our early 20s. And so Greg and his writing partner, Jason, came to Blumhouse. We just started spitballing ideas. They wanted to do this like evil teddy bear thing. And we just combined basically the four of us. I mean, we combined the three notions, Jason's challenge, my desire to play with subjectivity, and their notion of an evil teddy bear. And the result was the screenplay for Imaginary.
Were there films you were drawing up on from when you were young? Like, I'm always interested in those 80s, especially for us, like our generation, movies in the 80s were so playful, so creative, just like this, in that sense that they're using a lot more fantasy than maybe is popular right now with the A24 kind of vibes, right?
Yeah. I mean, with every movie I make, I try to identify touchstones because what I do is I put them on in my office and I just play them on the loop, even with the sound down during meetings. I tell all the department heads, I pull still images. I mean, I want those touchstones to kind of imbue all the choices that we're making in pre-production. And for this film, the two touchstones, one of them was one of those films from the 80s. It was the original Poltergeist from 1982.
The clown.
It was so scary. I saw it when I was six. It messed me up. I was like a normal kid before I saw that movie. And I started having brutal nightmares. But also it embodied that playfulness. I mean, it's both incredibly scary. It's not a horror comedy, but it's got laughs. It's got emotion. It just works on so many levels. And that's what we were trying to do with Imaginary.
Yeah. And any other films that you kind of saw as like the starting point for it?
I mean, look, certainly there's psychological horror references. There's horror fantasy references, which is kind of an underserved subgenre in the market, kind of that space that exists between like Labyrinth and Hellraiser. But specifically, I would say Pan's Labyrinth was another major touchstone for us.
That's interesting.
Very cool. Excellent. So, and I know you're going to get asked this on every press junket that you do for the next 2 weeks, but did you have an imaginary friend?
Well, I already have an answer to that question because I've been asked it many, many times. And the answer I serve up is, of course, I was a geeky little film nerd who collected comic books. All my friends were imaginary.
Oh, I love it. That's the best answer ever. Elric, imaginary friend.
I did not, but maybe co-writers. That's about it.
Co-writers.
Imaginary co-writers. But that's
you imagine they were your friends,
yeah.
But the truth is they weren't.
They're not. They're just waiting to stab us in the back.
Yes, exactly.
So I did. Her name was, and this isn't even a name. Her name was Krista Stalla. I don't even think it's a real
elaborate
name. That's very much like a name I made up at some point, Krista Stalla. And that wasn't even a first name and a last name. That was her first name, Krista Stalla. And I talked to her for like years when I was a kid and I have no clue what she looked like, but mom has like pictures of me having tea parties And in my brain, I'm like, oh, that was Krista. I was having tea with her. No clue what she looked like, but there she was. And I remember her presence more than anything, which is weird. And that was probably a solid 2 years of my life that I talked to her.
Yeah,
And my mom, she just let it go.
Just the creepy idea, this yeah. notion that a kid is like sitting there and having a conversation with something that's not there, or it's a stuffed animal or a doll or whatever, that they're like having this moment that feels very real to them, which to the outside observer, you know, looks like pretend. It's just so perfect for a horror movie.
Has there been much research into that? Like, I just wonder if you guys touch on that when you're doing the research for a script, like the actual psychological studies on children and stuff, or is it just more hearsay, I guess?
Well, research is the enemy of completing a screenplay, right? You can spend a year researching something and not write a single page. So I actually tend to work in a very specific way that was inspired by a moment in film school. We had a writer from Star Trek come in and speak to us. And he said on the staff of all the Star Trek shows, they always have like the science person. And their job is basically when everyone else writes their script, focusing only on story and character, they then give it to the science writer, who then writes all the science jargon and science stuff. Like the whole, what's it called? The flux capacitor. Am I blanking? They always say this one thing is broken during the teleportation thing. Why am I blanking on this? I hate this. It's the whole point of the story.
Anyway, oh gosh.
The science writer would always fill in the blanks with real science jargon. And so when I work on a script, I just skip all the like specificity about the real world stuff. And I just like fill in later. And that's what we did on this movie. So when Gloria is talking about real imaginary friends and different cultures, that was all written like very late in the game.
Once
we knew the story figured out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a smart way to do it. So it doesn't kind of taint the story itself and where it's going to head. Because I know if I was to research ahead of time, I feel like I'd be inclined to kind of write more towards the research so that it's historically accurate and such. Yeah. No, that's a great setup. So how did you... go ahead.
I think it's called the Heisenberg compensator. It's basically the idea, the reason why like teleportation will never really work is because there's always some variable of uncertainty in any kind of scientific equation or process, and you can't risk one molecule being off in a person when you teleport them. So you'll never actually have a real teleportation device. But the science writer on Star Trek, he said, well, we have the Heisenberg compensator, right? Like to try to deal with the real science.
I feel like they should have called it the Goldblum principle.
Yeah, the Brundlefly.
The Brundlefly principle right there. So yeah.
Anyway, my brain is moving very slowly.
You know, now I'm realizing how fucking creepy it is, because like Elric, you've seen my daughter carried around this stuffed dinosaur. She still has it for easily 8 years and talked to it continuously. And it had, maybe it's a good act of creativity, because Rex, which is its name, Rex has his own personality. He has foods he likes. He has a way of talking. He has a dialect. He has specific ways he dresses. And it's like a very distinctive personality. So we're going to call it early character building.
All right. I like it. Speaking of imaginary friends, you see that right there?
Oh, is that the bear? Oh, cool. Okay. The bear. So let's talk about the bear. So how do you design a teddy bear to look really creepy? Because somehow it does. It bridges both cute and creepy simultaneously. So like, what were the features that you were really zeroing in on?
I mean, it's tricky because the bear can't look like Annabelle, right? Because what kid is going to want to cuddle with that? But at the same time, you know, he can't look like Paddington or Winnie the Pooh, because then he doesn't really visually work in the sort of horror lexicon of iconic villains. So it was hard to pull off. It was very hard to pull off. And we spent a lot of time looking at different designs and talking about it. Ultimately, James Wan gave a note on some of the pre-production materials. Atomic Monster, his company, Blumhouse, were merging at the time. And I got a note related to me that came from him, which was a really focus on the asymmetry of the design. So that's why like Chauncey's ears are like this and his eyes are like that, because he can still be cute and cuddly, but the asymmetry kind of cues the audience to know that something's off, something's not right. You should feel unsettled when you're looking at him.
You know, if somebody's going to advise on making a doll creepy, I figure that James would definitely be the one.
He is the right one to do it.
Yeah.
He is the right one to do it.
100%. Okay. So where did you shoot this one?
I shot this one in New Orleans.
Oh, nice. Very cool. So what was the production process like? Can you talk a little bit about the filming of it?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. We were so lucky. We had the best crew you could ask for, honestly, because the strikes were coming. So
I
everyone's
was gonna say you
available.
like narrowly skirted the strikes,
Yeah,
right? This was wrapping right as it was starting.
we started shooting right after the writer's strike started. So the script was locked, it was done, no more writing. But fortunately, the directors made a deal, so I was able to keep working. And we were told that we better finish before the actor's contract expires, or they weren't going to give us the green light. So I did a board with my AD and kind of proved that we could get it done with a little bit of a buffer. And so I mean, honestly, we just like threaded the needle. We just barely got it in there, but we had the best crew available because no one was working at that point.
What draws you, just as a director, what draws you to, especially the three Blumhouse ones? They all have like big set pieces, big kind of fantasy slash game challenge elements to them, which I think is interesting with Fantasy Island. Obviously, that's built into the title. Truth or Dare is built into the gamification. But like, what is it that you usually are drawn to in terms of the challenge? Obviously, all films have multiple challenges, but for you, what do you tend to look for to get excited to invest a few years of your life into a film?
You know, it's really for me all about active storytelling. Like I can enjoy a passive experience as an audience member. Like I don't mind like a big broad comedy or a really like gratuitous over the top horror movie, but I don't think I would really make either of those kinds of movies. Like I like movies that sort of honestly engage the audience in a game. You know, I tell you the rules. These are then we're gonna have Then we're going to play with those rules. Then we're going to bend the rules. Maybe even break a rule. But we're going to show you that we told you we were going to break the rule back in the beginning of the movie. Like that sort of dialogue with the audience that invites them to lean in and really think about the images that are being presented, as opposed to just having them come at them in a sort of, I guess passive is the word I always come back to.
Is there a like sub horror subgenre that you have yet to get a chance to make that's like you're itching to make something in?
Like you really just want to do a found
That's a
footage
good
film or
question.
something like
Yeah.
that.
I don't know. I mean, of course, I'm a journal full of ideas.
Well, some things go out of vogue, like, somebody will be a monster, big monster kid when they're a kid. They'll grow up and those movies aren't made anymore. John Carpenter's a Western guy, but they don't really make
Yeah.
Westerns. So by the time he's a filmmaker, I'm always curious if somebody has that thing that they're always,
Yeah, but it's always the pendulum always
yeah.
swings
No, it
back.
does. Yeah.
Offer a new take on something. I guess it's just to me, it's just about like this concept that we talked about in film school, which is the same but different, right? That you always want to give the audience something that feels familiar, something that feels safe. I mean, there's a reason why, heroes win at the end of movies because that's what the audience want. They want something satisfying, the same, right? The familiar, but it needs to be different. You have to surprise them. You have to offer it in a fresh way, in a surprising way. So it's if I can kind of latch on to something that feels familiar, that has a sense of like it belongs to like a larger genre, a subgenre, or body of work. Like, oh yeah, that's a movie that I can relate to. I can think of like 5 to 10 other movies that have references to this sort of thing. But then I also have like a new idea. I'm like, oh, this hasn't been done before. This is my take on this. That's how I usually get excited.
Before, and I told you we were going to work in reverse, before we kind of jump back to kind of where you got your start in film, I want to talk about Curse of Bridge Hollow because we never get to talk adolescent horror on the show. And I consider it to be such an important like subgenre of horror, that gateway horror that just really doesn't exist anymore. And even Netflix, I was so excited because they did the Curse of Bridge Hollow and they had, oh gosh, the one that Ghost House did. What was it called? About the witch who had the kids tell her stories. I can't even remember the name now. But there were these like two adolescent horrors back, Nightbooks, two like adolescent horrors back to back that came to Netflix within a couple of years of each other. And they were the first that we'd seen in a long time. And then I've not seen more. So I would love to kind of hear what attracted you to Curse of Bridge Hollow and then kind of how you navigated adolescent horror, like making it still scary, but keeping it accessible to younger audiences.
Yeah, I mean, I like that you're delineating it from imaginary, because the term gateway horror gets thrown around a lot, and they are very different films.
There.
Imaginary is for horror fans too, whereas Curse is a little bit more of like an Amblin movie. You know, it's kind of like it exists in that sort of Gremlins kind of space where it's scary, but it's still very, very safe. You know, I sort of described it as like a horror Jumanji. So I think it kind of works in that kind of Robin Williams Jumanji lane as well. Did I answer your question?
I'd love to know kind of, had you always wanted to work in that space and what was it that kind of attracted you to it?
I like that Amblin space. I like working with kids. I like movies that are evocative of the films we loved in the 80s and early 90s. I think that kind of, that movie magic sometimes gets lost a little bit in the sort of the crazy CG whiz bang kind of anything is possible world that we live in now. And it's kind of slow things down a little bit, really lean into the wonder of it all and the character dynamics and just be a little bit more patient, but still make something that's, you know, thrilling and exciting. And I think I kind of got the bug for it on a TV show that I'd done just before it called Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Oh, yeah.
I did the second season of that reboot. And just love the scripts. I didn't write any of those scripts. You know, I just came on as a director and EP. But I love the scripts, love the world. It was kind of my like Stranger Things meets Goonies. And it actually is the main reason why I got Bridge Hollow, because I didn't write Bridge Hollow either. That was just an offer from Netflix. But I think they saw what I did with Afraid of the Dark and they wanted something similar.
No, I wish we had more films like this in this space, because this like is the reason that I am here, is films like Monster Squad and The Gate and things like that, that just where they were horror, but geared towards younger audiences and very accessible. And I'm sure that there will be kids who watch Imaginary and suddenly go, oh my God, that messed me up for life. I want more. And that's beautiful, but that's not gateway horror. I want the horror that's kind of made to bridge that gap.
Yes. Like for... It's scary still. That's the problem. Like sometimes people make these movies and they say they're for kids and they take all the scares out of it and just becomes kind of goofy and sort of more of a comedy. Like the scares need to still work, but you just don't, you just kind of, you play it from the kid's point of view and you just don't go quite so far.
Well, for Netflix, because I'm sure they all listen to our show. Netflix, I need more of those. So work on that. Let's get some more of those into prep right now. Yeah. Okay, so now since we're working in reverse, I'm going to take you all the way back. So I know you went through the program that I teach in now. You were USC grad student, right?
Correct. I was actually in the Peter Stark producing program.
Hell yeah. Okay, I'm directing. We're over in the other section. But yeah, so did you talk me through kind of how you went from your short film, your thesis film, to getting your first feature? Because that's always the biggest hurdle. So anytime somebody does it, I'm like, hell yeah, you did something right.
So I made this thesis film called The Tower of Babel, which was really just honestly a directing reel. It was three different stories, a drama, a comedy, and a thriller that had nothing to do with each other. Different casts, shot in different styles. But the one thing they had in common was that it was the same dialogue in all three stories. But the words meant different things given the context. And there was a frame at the beginning and the end that involved a monkey at a typewriter in like a surreal white space and a narrator talking about this theory that the English language, at least, is finite because there are a fixed number of letters and you assume a word can't be infinitely long. There's a fixed number of words. If you assume a sentence and then a paragraph, then a book and just follow this out, that you never have an infinite variable in theory. A computer could generate every possible iteration of the English language that you could ever come up with, even with nonsensical words. And so if you run that theory out, it means that like this computer, you know, because it's just randomized, it could be a billion monkeys at a billion typewriters, right? And so that's why we're talking about monkeys at typewriters. And this computer or these billion monkeys at a billion typewriters, not only would they like write Romeo and Juliet, they would write the next novel that Stephen King's going to write that he hasn't even written yet. They would also write the story of your life all by accident.
I remember there being a play about that I did in high school. It was like David Ives did. It was monkeys sitting around trying to write Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So did you actually have a monkey? That's like a feat for a student film. Did you actually have a monkey?
Yeah. We had this little, it's kind of not baby, but adolescent chimp. And that's when I learned that like adult chimps are not employable. They get sent to the sanctuary. The trainer, I remember he told me, he said, yeah, adult chimp gets mad. It's going to take about 10 men to hold him down, and they're going to lose a couple fingers. Yeah, it was a big deal. It was a big deal to have a monkey on set. And I remember being laughing that the monkey was the best paid performer on that whole film.
Did y'all have hazard forms back then? Because that would have been like all the... So now every single time a student does anything that's even remotely questionable to their safety or anybody's safety on set, we have a book of forms that they have to fill out called production safety plans and hazard forms. That would have been like all of them. That's like 100 different forms right there for a monkey.
Yeah, they gave us a list of things we were supposed to not do, like have moving vehicles, a ensemble cast, multiple locations, visual effects, animals. And fortunately, my two partners, Bo Bauman and Matt Stukin, who wrote the screenplay based on my story and produced it together for me, we kind of like all looked at each other and agreed, so we're going to do everything on that list, right? No, yeah, that's what we're going to do.
You can still do it. It's just a lot of forms now, but yeah. So what happened after you did the thesis film?
So I entered it into every single film festival that I could find because this was pre-YouTube. So, you know, to get your movie out there, we would go to this like porn producer in the valley and you'd give him your digibeta and he had like a stack of VHS decks and he would make copies. That's what all the film school students would do back then because there was no online distribution. You'd be handing out your tapes and you would mail them to every film festival you could get access to. And one of the film festivals I entered was called the Chrysler Million Dollar Film Festival. And it was a contemporary of Project Greenlights. Fortunately, there was no reality show aspect. They tried to do a reality show, but nobody won the rights. And it was a 7-month long sort of survivor for directors. I think we started with 30 directors and they whittled it down to like 10 and 5 and then one winner. And I had to do things like I had to fly to the Cannes Film Festival and make a short film featuring a Chrysler during the film festival. I had to move into like a mansion in Westwood and like write a script while they were like hosting all these parties, promoting the whole thing.
It's like real world, the filmmaker.
Yeah, it was insane. It was insane. And I won it with Bo Bauman's help. And then then they canceled it. I mean, this is a whole saga. I don't think it's a book, but it's certainly a very in-depth magazine article about how we made this first film. There's a lot of twists and turns, and we basically had to beg, borrow, and steal to get it done.
Wow. And from this, that is what got you Cry Wolf?
Correct. So we kind of conned the money out of the organizers of the contest and really just sort of scammed them. But we got the money and we made
it. You scammed them and
it's so complicated. I mean, I guess the short version is there are sort of three parties involved: Universal, Chrysler, and this production company called Hypnotic. And when they canceled the contest and didn't give us the money, they all started suing each other and nobody would talk to the other one. And so we convinced Universal to give us their portion of the $1 million, acted like we had all the money, started shooting, but then quickly ran out of money because we didn't have the full $1 million. And then Universal looked at our footage. They realized what we had done. They knew they were already on the hook. And so they said, well, here's the rest of the million. You don't get a penny more.
Huh. Wow. But it got the movie made.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we just have this energy of like, we don't have a choice right now. Like, we got to get this movie made. And so once that movie was made, though, we were kind of in the game. I mean, it's still a struggle. You know, you have to fight every day to get things, to sell things, to get into meetings, to get things made. I've had lots of ups and downs in my career, but certainly that that movie kind of like, you know, made it official that I was a director.
Yeah. So this is now Imaginary is going to be your third film for Blumhouse. Why do you keep coming back to Jason? I mean, when I worked there, I remember that it was always this, like, he respects the directors. He gives the directors say, he treats the directors like artists. Is that part of it? What keeps bringing you back to Jason?
I mean, Jason is a transformative figure in the film industry. 100 years from now, they're going to be studying his career the way I study Dahlberg or Selznick. He's really a special person who's doing something incredible. Few people can say they change the industry that they're participating in, and you can say that about Jason. So there's that kind of reason. Like, I just want to be a part of this thing because I think it's so special what he's doing. The other reasons are, he's a producer. He doesn't try to be a director. So many producers and executives are just trying to direct through you by giving notes and kind of overusing their authority, Whereas Jason doesn't do that. He really is a producer in the truest sense of the word. He like finds the material, he finds the people, he brings them together, he gets the thing financed, and he says, go do your jobs. And then you do your job and you come back to him. And you say, this is what we did. And he looks at it and he responds to it. And then he makes sure it's the best version of that thing. And then he takes it in the studio and he fights like hell to make sure they release it and market it properly. And he gets it out there into the world. And that's what a producer is supposed to do.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. This has been absolutely awesome. So we've got Imaginary coming out this weekend in theaters everywhere. Where else can they find it? Are there specific socials that we should be paying attention to?
I'm trying to think of off the top of my head. You can find me on Instagram at Jeff Wadlow, not F Jeff Wadlow, at Jeff Wadlow was what I was trying to say. And the movie, yes, is in theaters March 8th. It'll be everywhere. It's a wide release. Please go see it in theaters. I mean, it's so important to see these movies in theaters. A, you're going to have more fun, right? That's the best way to see a scary movie. And B, we have to keep theater going, a part of the filmmaking process. And if you don't go to the theaters, it goes away.
Hell yes. Elric and I will be there opening weekend. We are big proponents of going to the theaters to see every horror film that comes through for this very reason.
Plus, horror is constantly saving the industry. Every month, we're saving the entire film industry. So
I love that theory. We are pretty saving much, the industry every month. Chauncey is saving the industry this week. So yeah, I can't wait to go see this. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. This has been absolutely awesome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, guys. Take care.
Bye. Okay, that was great. And we now have had our creepy bear fixed. There might be more creepy bears. We decided we would just give you guys a couple each, maybe two to three each, creepy toy movie deep cuts. Some of them deep cuts, maybe better known. Let's see where you ended up. I'm curious.
Okay, so it's not all of them are kind of like, well, first off, not all of mine are movies, but even more so, not all of, you know what? They're not all bears.
I didn't do bears.
Oh, okay.
I just said creepy toy movies. Okay. We already had a bear.
Creepy toys. That I can do. So I'm going to start. This is not, I don't consider this a deep cut, and I don't think diehard horror fans from the 80s won't consider this a deep cut. But if you ask my students, none of them have fucking heard of this. So I wanted to start with Dolls.
Yeah.
Because honestly, even though it's probably a more well-known one, it's not a deep cut to nerds like us. I do consider this to be the best. This is one of the best scary doll movies, scary toy movies ever made across the board. And the Blu-ray I am holding from Scream Factory is absolutely outstanding. It is absolutely beautiful on this one. So yeah, this is a Brian Yuzna produced Stuart Gordon movie. So it's like horror legacy. But yeah, it's just an amazing, amazing film that I can't say enough good stuff about.
A lot of care goes into the actual, you know, the puppets and the dolls themselves. And there's that giant bear scene. That does have a bear.
It does have a giant bear. You're
which
right.
Which is very unexpected in that movie. The moment it pops in, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. The main doll is called Punch, but there's a lot of dolls in this because it's literally like a doll maker. And so there's a lot. But this one scared. We were just talking about this with Jeff Wadlow. This one fucked me up when I was six because my parents rented this for me when I was really young. And it literally, the front cover of the original movie had a doll holding an eyeball on the cover.
That's a good cover.
But my mom was still like, yeah, sure, fine, rent this. And I was probably in third grade and watched it. And it's a very adult movie.
Yeah, I didn't see that one young.
Messed me up.
That one I missed when I was young. I loved all of Stuart's stuff, but that one I hadn't seen until I was a bit older. It's really technically great movie too. You know, I watched one just a couple. It's funny that we picked this to do as a subcategory. I had never seen this when it came out. I remember when it got re-released, I was like, yeah, it looks kind of silly. Dolly Dearest. I had not seen this when I was young, especially. I knew about it. I've seen the cover. It's obviously a Child's Play ripoff. But if you had asked me what this movie actually is, I would have probably just said, oh, it's probably set in suburban America where somebody gets a crappy girl doll and does the same thing that Chucky does. So I
feel like that's exactly what I perceived it as.
I thought that's what this was. And I was with a couple of our friends, Star and Dick, and we read this movie, and Luke Petrowski, and my jaw was on the ground in the first few minutes because it's Denise Crosby from Star Trek, right, and Pet Sematary. And
great start.
Her husband is a toy manufacturer who buys a factory in Mexico. So the whole film's set in Mexico, for one thing, which I was not expecting, next to an Aztec Mayan temple that has been closed.
Well, that's a heavy swing
with a
there.
Massive cult of ghosts from the Aztec ghosts get into the dolls and take over. And so we're watching this movie. And then who would make sense if you're making a thing with Aztec ghosts going into dolls? Who is missing from this movie? How about Rip Torn? If I had known Rip Torn was in Dolly Dearest, I would have watched this many years ago.
That none of this goes together. Let me just say that none of this goes together.
And crazy good animatronics, actually, but animatronics that are kind of good, but also kind of not as good as Chucky. So the dolls are actually even creepier because the animatronics have that. It is that uncanny feeling. And what's interesting, you're watching it. Basically, this family goes to Mexico. They are trying to reopen this plant of these dolls that was closed down because there's obviously a ghost in there. And you think it's just the one doll. So she's got the young girl has one doll. She becomes very close friends with it. The doll starts killing people in their family, everything you would expect. But it has this just absolute banger moment. I like this more than everyone else I watched it with, just to be honest. Everyone else was kind of like, eh. And I walked afterwards. I was like, this movie ripped. But there's a scene where suddenly you're in the factory and like three or four of them have come to life. And so that's when it got really exciting to me because it wasn't just the one. It's like multiple of them attacking people as Rip Torn is trying to close the Mayan temple. It's pretty crazy. It's kind of like a bit Poltergeist, a bit Mayan Adventure.
Rip Torn runs the Mayan temple?
He's an academic who's had to come from the major university because somebody has died in the opening scene in the temple.
If I was casting an academic to come speak on the history of the Mayans, I would not necessarily head to Rip Torn first, but okay.
You'd have to have an academic from a university to be able to decipher the accent that Rip Torn does in this film because we had multiple, at one time it's just Rip Torn. Then it's probably a Hispanic kind of Mexican vibe, and then it sounds like Italian. It changes multiple times. It's actually a very fun movie, and it's 10 times more kind of crazy than what I thought it was going to be in terms of ripoffs. I knew it was a ripoff, and it certainly is that. But I must say, because of the setting, I actually had a very good time. Dolly Dearest has a Blu-ray
okay,
now.
Okay, Dolly Dearest, I'm going to be watching you for an upcoming Deep Cut episode.
That's what I was watching it for, by the way. It would have been on our next Deep Cuts until this fell into our lap, so...
Okay, so next up on my list, this is a total deep cut. This is like no one has fucking watched this shit but me. And it's amazing. South Korean Hansel and Gretel from 2007.
You're holding a Blu-ray, so that's a good sign.
I am holding a Blu-ray. This, it's like one of the Tartan Asian Extremes, if memory serves. Maybe. Nope, maybe not. This may not be one of the Tartans. No, I have no idea what I got this from. I don't even think it's region one. Okay, I don't know where I got this from, but I have a Blu-ray of it. So Hansel and Gretel 2007. This may not even be the Western region, but who knows? So this movie, it does not follow the tale of Hansel and Gretel exactly. It's more of kind of Misery, if Misery was a fairy tale. It's about a guy who is traveling through this woodland, snowy environment. He's got his own demons, and he gets into a car wreck, and he wakes up, and he has kind of been taken in. He's wandering through the snow. He doesn't know what's going on. He's completely lost. He gets taken in by this weird family that lives miles away from everybody else in the middle of the woods. And it's a mom, a dad, and three kids. But everything in this family is creepy, like cake for breakfast. And the whole house is full of toys. And everything seems to be constantly about playing. And it's basically like one giant nursery room that the house is designed about. And then he quickly realizes that there's something magical about the house, that something is happening here. That the house has got this magical quality. And you realize really quickly that the kids are controlling it, that the kids are in charge, that the parents are being kept there hostage. They now, and if they are even their real parents, that's called into question. This is all in the first act. He's not allowed to leave anymore. If you think like that Twilight Zone episode from the movie about like the house that's being controlled by the sun, and then they won't let her leave. It's this if it was a fairy tale. And because it is kids kind of controlling everything, there is a lot of stuff happening with dolls and stuffies moving around. And at one point, they turn somebody into a doll. This movie has some of the scariest stuffy scenes I can think of in a movie because they're just bringing things to life and they're using what the kids have around them to do kind of the torturous stuff a lot of the time to do the scares. And a lot of it is dolls and toys. So this movie, the production design on this movie is, oh my gosh, it's just beautiful. But the movie across the board is a really tight fucked up watch. So basically, Misery, if Misery was a fairy tale with a bunch of like really messed up kids. Hansel and Gretel, 2007, South Korean.
Yeah, that sounds cool. I haven't seen that one. One I talked about probably a couple years ago on the Deep Cuts is Umberto Lenzi's Ghost House from 1988.
Yes.
And this one wouldn't have made money except that they retitled it in Italy La Casa 3, which meant Evil Dead 3. So literally everyone in Italy who went to this were being told it was the third part of Sam Raimi's trilogy, which is pretty awesome. That's just so Italian. Anyway, this has nothing to do with Evil Dead. This is a really fun movie, a really, you know, like classic, you know, bonkers movie we would talk about. But it opens with a funeral home. And the father who runs the funeral home, he steals some things from his clients and people have died with, and then gives it to his daughter. And this one time he gives this big clown doll to the daughter that's obviously creepy, and it turns out to be demonic. And that night it murders, with the demon inside the doll, murders the parents. And then it cuts to 20 years later, and there's some guy in like Boston. Yeah, Boston, by way of Italy or whatever, on a radio, and he gets and he hears on a radio, he hears, or like a walkie-talkie kind of radio, whatever you call that, like truckers would use or whatever, he hears some screaming, and he's hearing events from 20 years ago taking place on the signal, which is actually a really cool hook. And then a bunch of teenagers move into the house, you know, to hang out, run into these people who are on the frequency, and basically this clown comes back. And there are some really, like, speaking, you know, we were just talking to Jeff about the Kinder Trauma of Poltergeist. This is obviously copying the exact clown, but making it like there's a scene where he's huge. He's like twice as big as the people. And it's just, it's very effective and very silly, over the top, but it works. It's I think it's a very fun movie. Bonus points, it was filmed in the house from Fulci's house by the cemetery, which I thought was neat.
Ooh,
so it is in America, nice. That part. Yeah.
Okay, so the last one that I'm going to do, it's actually a TV show episode, okay. Not a movie. But this, I saw this when I was really young, and or not really young, I was probably like 9 or 10, but it messed me up, and I still consider it to be the scariest episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark? The Tale of the Dollmaker from season 3, which is about a little girl who goes to visit her, I think it's like her aunt and uncle or her grandparents every year in the summertime. And she always plays with this girl who lives next door, Susan. And she gets there in the summer and Susan's gone. And she's like, what happened to my friend that I always played with? And her grandparents, her uncle, I can't remember which it is, tell her that Susan went missing. Like her friend from next door disappeared without a trace, and that Susan's parents were so completely messed up that they just left the house. They just vacated and left the house. And so the little girl, Melissa, becomes convinced that Susan is still in the house, that there is something weird going on, that even though the house is completely vacated now and her parents are gone, she is determined to figure out what happened to Susan and why she disappeared without a trace. And so she starts exploring Susan's old house. And what she finds in the attic is this dollhouse that is an exact replica of Susan's house.
That's cool.
And she realizes that if you kind of walk through the house in a particular manner, you will end up in the dollhouse. Like you will literally be transformed into the dollhouse. And there she finds Susan, who has been turned into a doll, like complete with like frozen hands, and her face is freezing and she's cracking and she's porcelain. And she realizes that this girl has to figure a way to get her out and get back out. And it's the whole thing is just about this house with a dollhouse replica that will turn you into a doll if you stay in it for too long. It is so fucked up and scary the way that they show their bodies turning into dolls and what's happening to them. It doesn't sound scary as I'm describing, but holy shit, watching this as an 8-year-old and seeing like these actresses like turn to porcelain, it was so messed up. So this, when I think like scary doll movies, this is always going to be the first one that I think of, The Tale of the Dollmaker from season 3 of Are You Afraid of the Dark? And I know that I'm not by myself on this one, because anytime I have talked about Are You Afraid of the Dark with other people, this episode always comes up. This was like total kinder trauma for an entire generation.
I think porcelain is scarier than plastic. You know, when thinking about skin and humans being underneath something, I've seen things like that before. Plastic dolls don't, I don't know, it's not as interesting to me. There's something about porcelain that feels so delicate and old dolls.
It's porous and always very kind of, it's got like a paleness to it. And
it's
yeah,
fragile compared to plastic.
My
last
this
one.
This episode was so messed up.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen those, so I wouldn't mind seeing that.
If your kids are into scary stuff, they're worth revisiting. I have watched most of the original ones with my son. Marnie was not too into them, but Strummer has watched every single one.
Well, my favorite, I say, just it's a movie I'll never get tired of telling people to watch because they usually will hear the title and be like, that can't be good. But we both know it is. And that is Silent Night, Deadly Night 5, The Toymaker.
Oh, yes.
This is one of the great underrated, because the effects are so good, by Screaming Mad George, all the creatures, which are toys that have been perverted toys, because Mickey Rooney as Joe Petto, dressed as Santa Claus, a toy maker in this town, has been making these very dark, destructive toys. That in the opening scene, a dad, you know, has come downstairs and the toy's kind of jumping out of its wrapping, and the kid comes down the stairs and watches him as his dad is brutally murdered by a Santa Claus toy that turns deadly. And they're just so creative. It's not a scary movie, but it is a very fun one. It's very silly. It's part five of a franchise, so it shouldn't be nearly this good. From 91, Brian Yuzna is a co-producer. But what's really great about this is the fact that Mickey Rooney is the person in the who wrote one of the key letters of protest against the original Silent Night, Deadly Night, trying to have it pulled for moral reasons, saying anyone behind
this
is
know
scum.
This.
He's one of the main guys who called them scum for polluting the image of Christmas. And by part five, he is dressed as Santa Claus, killing people and making dangerous toys. So you got to love that. That is a Hollywood story right there.
You know that Yuzna did that.
Oh, it
Yuzna
has to be.
Was like,
has to be.
Let's get that. Let's get Mickey Rooney
it's
now.
Just
He'll
too
do
funny,
it.
Too
oh
funny.
My gosh.
But this is a much better and much more fun movie than it has any right to be. So if you're looking for a fun creature, I would do a quick honorable mention because the whole movie's not, but I think my favorite movie that has small things doing stuff is the part of the anthology Asylum, that British anthology. That is just a brilliant anthology in general, but the one that has these little figurines almost like war soldiers is terrific too. So
And quick shout out to the Amityville doll one.
Oh yeah, the Dollhouse.
I can't even remember maybe? Which one. The Dollhouse. Yeah, so, that one is one of the really good Amityvilles as well.
Yeah, they give. I mean, there's we're obviously skipping a lot of the classic favorites, but I think that just gives you guys, if after you watch Imagination at the
Imaginary.
Imaginary.
Well, we
yeah.
haven't mentioned The Pit.
I mean, The Pit's, well, I was going to bring
you
up
not
the Teddy.
Mention The Pit.
Weirdly enough, to me now, that is no longer a deep cut. That is the mainstream cinema of the universe. In my brain,
it's
everyone,
practically Halloween. I mean, it's maybe Halloween too, but still, it's Halloween.
Yeah, you got troglodytes. Right, I mean, all good movies should suddenly cut to troglodytes in a pit.
So this is, since this is mainstream for Elric, the story, it's a very complicated story about a boy who has a pit of monsters in his backyard and is like sacrificing people to it. But additionally, he carries around this teddy bear, but without explanation, the teddy bear kind of moves on its own.
Yeah. It looks very ominous.
They never really explain it. And it's got kind of a monstery thing going on in it, but he just carries around a teddy bear. It's very creepy.
It's a great movie. That's a classic Canadian movie that should be royalty for this show.
It should.
Yeah.
Well, if you would like some more deep cuts from us, be them toy related or not, you can head over to our Patreon show, Deep Cuts, where we do two shows a month, as well as post lists of other deep cut movies. We do two of those a month as well. And otherwise, we will be back in 2 weeks with another exciting show and some fun new guests. And I'm glad that horror has finally picked up for 2024. We're seeing a lot of new releases and we've got plenty more on the way.
Yes, we've got a very 80s episode ahead. Look forward to it.
The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.